Sup, you beautiful bastards. I hope you had a fantastic Wednesday evening, Thursday morning. You're watching the Philip DeFranco Show, your daily dive into the news, and we got a lot to talk about today. So buckle up, hit that like button, and let's just jump into it.
Starting with,
we've got to talk about our douchebag of the day, this guy, who's now been identified as 21-year-old Thomas Elliott. Because at least on one day, Thomas woke up and was like, I'm gonna just be a dirty, dirty scumbag at Target. And we only know about Thomas thanks to this woman who noticed that he was following her around the store in Greenville, North Carolina, where they're deciding to just subtly begin filming him. And thank God she did, because the camera captured this, where the guy's clearly and obviously sticking his phone underneath another woman's skirt.
Excuse me, what are you doing? No, I just saw you put that underneath her dress. Absolutely you did.
No, ma'am, I really wasn't.
You absolutely did.
Ma'am, I really wasn't.
You've been extremely close to me this whole time. Please show me your phone.
No.
I really don't want
to. Let's get security.
I really promise I wasn't trying to do anything inappropriate.
Uh-uh.
I wasn't. I'm not like that.
Obviously you are. I literally have it on video.
So after that, a security guard shows up, they call the police, and the man gets arrested for felony secret peeping. And as far as who is 21-year-old Thomas Elliott, turns out this creepy scumbag is a volunteer for an elementary school and a church. Or rather, he was, because both places have now kicked his dirty ass out. And as far as online, you know, you got people reacting to his alleged crime with disgust, also with delight to his arrest. But also, for me, it's just another, it's not really a revelation. I think it's something that we all kind of know, is that we never really know what's going on with a person. Someone who on paper appears to be an outstanding citizen serving their community could also in reality be so many different kinds of a monster. And then this ridiculous Marquez Brownlee situation, controversy, scandal, whatever you want to call it, I just call it ridiculousness, that I covered on Monday, that has just continued to grow. In fact, so much so, with more and more people demonizing the man, that MKBHD himself made a response video. Right? And all of this largely because of his review of the Humane AI pen. You know, this little pen that can send calls and texts and answer questions instead of a screen. It projects light onto your hand. Well, reviewers like Marquez noted, you know, in the future, this could be a good product. And the build, like the fact that they're able to get so much in a form factor, that is impressive. Pretty much across the board, the reviews for this thing were so bad, slamming its limited functions, inaccuracies, how slow it was, and a whole lot more, with Marquez even calling it the worst product that he's ever reviewed yet. And while many people responded to that review going like, man, Marquez, Thanks for looking out. Thanks for giving your honest review on something that I might have spent $700 plus a monthly fee on. There were also a lot of people who, in my opinion, were either being overly sensitive and or have worms for brains, demonizing the man, saying that he is a careless, bad actor, that his review was irresponsible, that he was, and people use this word, murdering this company by giving his honest and universally agreed upon opinion. So with the conversation seemingly not ending on this, MKBHD put out a video where, among other things, he says he doesn't think that Humane is going anywhere, and also adding,
I think there is some pretty simple logic we can use to decipher what the real danger is to these companies, which is, do you still get a bunch of negative reviews and then die as a company if the product is actually really good?
Right, is it the bad reviews killing it, or is it the bad product itself? Right, with him going on to note that when he reviews a product, he's not trying to service the company that made it, he is trying to service the viewer on the other side. So he has to be upfront if he wants his review to be productive.
But the thing about reviews is, if they're not honest, then they're basically useless.
Marquez adding that a negative review can actually help a company, right? Noting that he once reviewed a phone that had a horrible vibrate function, and then when they showed Marquez a newer iteration of the phone, they said, hey, look, we fixed the vibrate. And that maybe doesn't happen if not for honest feedback. And then regarding whether he has ever killed a company by giving that feedback, he pointed back to another recent controversy when he gave a negative review of the Fisker Ocean car, that company being seen as being on life support for a few months after he published his thoughts.
First of all, I was not the only one to review the car, not even close. And so yes, the stock price did drop after my video, but the stock was in free fall for many, many months before my video too. And if you zoom out on YouTube or in the car review space in general, I was far from the only person saying these things about the car for all of these months.
Right, because while in both situations he kind of became the poster boy for that take, this was the general consensus, and the same applies to the human AI pen. He was not alone, and his thoughts were very much in line with others. Right, and so he closed by saying, you don't get bad reviews without a bad product. You know, something that also makes this extra silly is the fact that even people at Humane, they've been responding to his video more evenly than many others, with the head of new media at Humane even writing, all fair and valid critiques, both the good and the bad. Feedback is a gift. We reflect and we listen and we learn and we continue building. He's very good at his job, and I encourage him to keep doing his thing and to stay true to himself in the craft. But the last thing I'll say is, I'm a little bit of a reviewer myself, and I give Marquez's video a 10 out of 10. You never quite know how a creator is going to react when the pressure is on, the heat is turning up. And this video also exemplified why so many people go to Marquez. In the face of so much stupid, he stood his ground and he let the world know the only people I'm responsible to are my viewers, people that might purchase products. And he did so in a thoughtful, smart, and measured way, even though the whole situation warranted a much more vicious response. And then people are tripping over themselves and losing their minds over how much money Caitlin Clark is going to make in the WNBA. But she's been the biggest name in female college basketball, hell, really all college basketball. She was also, as expected, the number one woman picked in the draft, with it then quickly coming out that that will make her $76,535 in her first year in the league, with her four-year rookie deal coming in at $338,056. With also a lot of people learning with that news that picks 1 through 4 earn that in the WNBA. With then people quickly comparing that to the NBA, where last year's number one pick landed a four-year contract worth $55 million. With people saying the fact that Caitlin's making less than 1% of her male counterpart, that's wild. Especially since it can't be overstated what an impact she's had on the sport. Right, this year, the women's NCAA championship game brought in more eyeballs than the men's, averaging nearly 19 million viewers compared to the men at under 15 million. And with all this, among those sounding off, you have other athletes like Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Russell Wilson, who wrote, "These ladies deserve so much more, praying for the day." And others saying things like, "On this salary, Caitlin Clark would qualify for low-income housing in San Francisco." Hell, even Joe Biden spoke out, writing, "Women in sports continue to push new boundaries and inspire us all. But right now, we're seeing that even if you're the best, women are not paid their fair share. It's time that we give our daughters the same opportunities as our sons and ensure women are paid what they deserve." But here is also the reality. If I asked you, how many WNBA games have you watched in your life, what would the answer be? How many of the WNBA team names did you know prior to the draft yesterday? And understand, I don't mean this to shit talk, because I do believe that this is about to change, with the likes of Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese leading the charge. But they are the wave, not the current reality. And the timing of all this is so important. The media rights deal for the WNBA, it is up. And the eyes these young women have drawn, those are going to be powerful. And I have no doubt that viewership will go up, attendance will increase, more money will be spent, and there will very likely be many changes, including to salaries, with hopefully the athletes responsible for this change being the first to see the benefit. And sure, as other people have noted, the likes of Caitlin Clark, right, she's going to be fine. She's raked in tons of cash from endorsements and other stuff, but that's not the standard situation for a lot of the athletes in the WNBA. So I guess all of that is to say, I was personally not shocked when I saw that salary, and I'm also not going to be shocked when we all see those numbers go up in the coming years. And for those that were outraged, they want to see change, go buy tickets. Go watch the games. It's a business, and it's still in its early, early stages. I mean, hell, just think about this. The NBA rookie minimum is $953,000, right? And that's based on the NBA as we know it today. When Michael Jordan was drafted number 3 back in 1984, he made much less than that. When Michael Jordan was drafted 3rd overall, he made $455,000 his first year. Even if you argued about inflation, you're talking about $1.36 million, which is not that far from a rookie contract. And then, you know, when I heard that 1 in 5 Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list, it instantly made me want to remind you of the deal that you can get using my link at babbel.com/DeFranco for up to 60% off. Yes, really, and that's thanks to the fantastic partner, the PDS, Babbel. But right now, you could move towards completing that goal of learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Because, you know, Babbel works because they focus on teaching you modern conversations that you use in the real world using native speakers, not computers. And Babbel's personalized learning content, real-time feedback, tracking, and visualizations help keep you focused and motivated. Plus, I think you, like I found myself doing, will really enjoy the sound that you hear when you get it right. I mean, one study even found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a semester at college. So if you're serious about speaking another language, what Babbel can promise you are useful language skills along with learning the context, traditions, and culture that the language you're learning is grounded in. So here's a special limited time deal just for y'all. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for you at babbel.com/DeFranco. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/DeFranco, spelled BABBEL.com/DeFranco. Rules and restrictions may apply. And then, so unfortunately, it is not a secret that we have a problem with police violence in this country. The U.S. far surpassing most wealthy democracies in the number of people killed by police. But what's also notable, and what I really want to talk about today, is how many of these deaths actually occur when police are trying to avoid killing. And specifically, what I'm talking about here is what police call less lethal force, which is this catch-all term to describe common tactics used to stop people without causing, quote, serious bodily harm or death. Except when misused, that's often exactly what happens, as was the case when police murdered George Floyd in 2020. 2020. While that encounter was caught on video, it was forced in front of all our faces, many others throughout the United States have escaped notice. And the DOJ has actually acknowledged that its data on these types of encounters is incomplete, and they blame inadequate reporting from police departments. But it also doesn't make the information it does have publicly available. And that's exactly why this new investigation led by the Associated Press is so valuable. Right? It gives a new understanding of exactly how big of a problem this is, with a finding, among other things, that over a decade, more than 1,000 people have died after police subdued them through means not intended to be lethal. And even more than that, the investigation has provided us with new insights into who is most affected, how these encounters typically play out, and why they keep happening. So let's dive in. Now, to be precise, the investigation logged 1,036 deaths from 2012 through 2021. This was a three-year effort that involved 7,000 requests for government documents and body camera footage, the review of more than 700 autopsy reports or death certificates, and the uncovering of multiple videos that had never been published or widely distributed. And notably, the Associated Press says that the number is almost certainly an undercount, noting that many police departments blocked access to information, blacked out files and blurred videos, and shared reports that routinely used vague language or glossed over use of force. Right? But of the numbers that were known, 740 of the deaths were the result of the same supposedly non-lethal tactic that killed George Floyd, a so-called prone restraint, where the person's held face down on their stomach, often using the officer's body weight. Then you had 538 deaths resulting from a taser or a stun gun. And in dozens of other cases identified by the AP, people died after being given sedatives without consent, with strikes from fists or knees, takedowns, and other restraint devices also commonly being used. And notably, these deadly encounters happened all across the country. They happened in big cities, suburbs, rural areas. But most commonly, they occurred in or near the home of the person who was killed. And while those who died came from all walks of life, there were some trends that stuck out. Like, for one, the vast majority of those killed were men, usually in their 30s and 40s, though the youngest was just 15 and the oldest was 95. Also, many victims were impaired by medical, mental health, or drug issues. And perhaps most notably, though not surprisingly, Black Americans were disproportionately affected, making up a third of those who died, despite representing only 12% of the U.S. population. And the reason that I say it's not surprising is because this is reflective of the same trend we see again and again in this country when it comes to policing, with just one example of this being the Justice Department's own findings that Black people account for more unjustified stops for minor offenses, more illegal searches that produce no contraband, and more instances of unnecessary force or arrest without probable cause. You know, the 2015 case of Donald Ivey Jr., it's one of those cases where you see these different aspects of race, mental health, and the use of force converge. He was a 39-year-old Navy vet with schizophrenia, and police thought that he looked suspicious because he was walking with a lean and only had one hand in the pocket of his coat, though his family argued that he was just racially profiled. And while Ivey was cooperative at first, he began to resist when the officers laid hands on him, which is also a known trigger for some that have severe mental illness. This led to the officers tasing Ivey, chasing him down, beating him with batons, tasing him several more times, and then putting him in a prone restraint. And after Ivey stopped breathing, the department quickly ruled that the officers acted appropriately and blamed a medical crisis for his death. And so what we also see with this tragedy is another one of the key findings from this investigation, that officers regularly resort to force even in circumstances that aren't imminently dangerous to them. In fact, it was actually only in about 30% of the cases looked at by AP that the police faced potential or clear danger. And something that's been noted there is it doesn't necessarily also mean deadly danger. It was often someone taking a swing at the officer or charging them. Though I should also note with that, right, there were cases where police made a real effort to subdue a suspect non-lethally even when their lives were on the line, such as when three Massachusetts officers arrived on a scene where, quote, a 6'6" bodybuilder was stabbing his date so viciously that the walls were red with her blood. But with that said, we see many more cases where it seems hard to justify any use of force at all. In fact, according to the AP's findings, roughly 25% of those who died weren't harming anyone and were at most committing low-level infractions or causing minor disturbances. And 45% of them were fleeing or non-violently resisting arrest. And on top of all that, the AP found hundreds of cases where officers failed to follow best safety practices for the application of these so-called less lethal tactics, with that including dozens of cases where officers disregarded people who told them that they were struggling for air or even about to die, with them often uttering the same words that George Floyd did, "I can't breathe." One of the reasons this happens so often is that the U.S. has no national rules for the use of force. And even though Supreme Court decisions have set broad guidelines for the use of force, it's still basically up to the states and local law enforcement to sort out the specifics in terms of their training and policies. And without real standards holding officers accountable, it's almost impossible. Right? I mean, in Donald Ivey's case, for example, a grand jury declined to indict even though his death was classified as a homicide. And it was only after years and years of fighting for justice that his family settled with the city for $625,000. And in fact, of the 1,036 deaths identified in this investigation, only 28 resulted in charges. And more often, officers were just cleared by their own departments and internal investigations, but that including some who had a history of violence or were involved in multiple deadly encounters. And then even if an internal investigation recognized that the use of force here, it was excessive, there weren't always consequences. Carl Grant, for example, was a 68-year-old former Marine with dementia who was pushed down the stairs and body slammed inside of a hospital. And the officer responsible, they just received a 15-day suspension. While Grant, his punishment was that he eventually died from his injuries. What's more, the vast majority of cases like Grant hence they were ruled as accidental, natural, or undetermined. With the medical examiners and coroners sometimes relying on, quote, debunked science or incomplete studies from sources tied to law enforcement. And the investigation also finding that local and state authorities sometimes withheld information or omitted potentially damaging details from the reports. That's what we see with things like the case of Tyler Ware, who was another former Marine who ran from an officer and was attacked by a police dog, jolted by a stun gun, pinned on the ground, and injected with a sedative. And all of that barely mentioned in a letter from the prosecutor's office, who declined to bring charges and praised the officers for, quote, their incredible patience and restraint. Right, and Rare was one of 142 cases identified by AP whose death was ruled as excited delirium, which notably is something that major medical groups say is not a legitimate diagnosis, rather just a way of justifying excessive force. Of course, with all this, there are people who say, you know, 1,000 encounters turning deadly over 10 years? That's a pretty small fraction of the millions of police interactions that took place over that time. And with that, Peter Moskus, a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, telling AP, the only way to get down to zero is to get rid of policing, and that's not going to save lives either. But this, of course, is you have others saying, you know, there's a lot of room between 0 and 1,000. That's a lot of accidentally spilled milk or broken eggs. Also, it's not spilled milk or broken eggs, it's human lives. And as this investigation and other data shows, there's often no good reason for things to turn deadly. And unfortunately, when it does, the data shows that it's often the result of police aggression and the incorrect application of these supposedly less than lethal tactics. And this is, people argue, like, the idea that it's inevitable that we're going to see this happen, that's just kind of a blind justification, as other democracies just don't have the same problem at this level. And or, at the very least, something that would be very helpful for this whole situation is more data and transparency, both in general, but also specifically how and why people are dying here. That's the first step with dealing with the situation and problem. But with all that said, I got to pass the question off to you. What are your thoughts and opinions here? And then, you know, nowadays, after a night out with drinks, I do not bounce back the next day like I used to. So usually I have to make a choice. I can either have a great night or have a great next day. That is, I will say, until I found the fantastic sponsor of today's show, ZBiotics. Right, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut, and that byproduct is a big reason why you feel so rough the next morning. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. It's designed to work like your liver, but in your gut, where you need it most. So just drink ZBiotics before drinking alcohol, drink responsibly, and get a good night's sleep to feel your best tomorrow. I will say, the first time that I tried it, I drank a bottle before I went to a Chargers game, before any alcohol, and so I ended up just being amazed at how good I felt the next day. You know, it's nice to be thankful about the good decisions made by yesterday, Phil, when you're today, Phil, without having to sacrifice what feels fun for today, Phil, now for tomorrow, Phil. You know, it's great for those nights, but also vacations, weddings, birthdays, reunions. I mean, there's so much going on. So get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. Just go to ZBiotics.com/DeFranco and use code DeFranco to get 15% off your first order. That's ZBiotics.com/DeFranco using code DeFranco at checkout for 15% off. And thanks, ZBiotics, for sponsoring today's show. And then we should talk about this Asna Tabassum situation. Because right now, a lot of people from all sides are accusing USC of hating free speech. And most of that now stemming from USC canceling next month's valedictorian graduation speech. Right? Because Asna is the valedictorian. She actually learned that her speech was going to be canceled before she even submitted anything to the university, which has led to accusations that they were silencing Tabassum, who is openly pro-Palestinian and even has a minor in resisting genocide, which I didn't know was a thing you could minor in until today. Also, if you're curious, her major is biomedical engineering. And with this, it seems like the issue really wasn't what she was going to say, but instead because of the backlash around her becoming valedictorian. Because at USC, over 100 students were eligible and she was voted to be it. With some of the backlash seemingly stemming from a link on her Instagram profile that went to the Free Palestine card. With the site talking about what's going on in Palestine and attacks Zionism as an ideology. And it contains language like, one Palestinian state would mean Palestinian liberation and the complete abolishment of the state of Israel, where both Arabs and Jews can live together. And according to USC, all this prompted enough threats that it was willing to cancel the speech over safety concerns. Now with this, you know, there are heightening tensions on the campus between pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel groups. But also, as people have noted, the school has a long history of letting people make speeches that heavily touch on political and societal topics. Also, there's the fact that the university refuses to share any details about these threats, which has led to speculation that it was just a cover to block Tabassum, with there being a belief they wouldn't want her touching on sensitive topics amid tensions. So this is, there were people who also defended their decision, arguing that they're a private institution and thus there's no inherent right to free speech there. Also notably, Tabassum herself made it seem like her speech wasn't even going to be particularly political. But they're telling the New York Times that in broad strokes, it was a talk about hope and how we must continue to use our education as a privilege to inform ourselves and ultimately make a change in the world. With her then going on to say, the university has betrayed me and caved into a campaign of hatred. And saying that USC's decision here, it not only silences her, but every pro-Palestinian activist on the campus. But also saying, when you silence silence us, you make us louder. You make louder the aims of imparting hope and commitment to human rights and the responsibilities of graduates to use our education to make the world a better place. So of course, with USC making this decision and a twist of their hopes, all of this is likely going to fire up pro-Palestinian activists on the campus. And if they hold those rallies, you're likely going to hear, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Which of course has been its own controversy on campuses, but also a controversy in the U.S. House of Representatives, because the House just voted to condemn it as anti-Semitic. And this wasn't a close vote either, with 377 representatives voting in favor and just 44 rejecting the condemnation and one rep not voting either way. And this is, you know, it's been a hot button issue for years now, and especially since the most recent war between Israel and Gaza, especially because depending on who you ask, it can have very different meanings. But what was interesting in the House is that it's a growing sign of just how split the Democrats are on the issue of Israel and Palestine, because all 44 of those who voted against the measure were from the progressive bloc of the party, right? AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, among others. And Tlaib, who notably already had been formally condemned for past statements that she wrote about the conflict, wrote on Twitter, "From the river to the sea is an aspirational call for freedom, human rights, and peaceful coexistence, not death, destruction, or hate. My work and advocacy is always centered in justice and dignity for all people, no matter faith or ethnicity." But this is also Dems who voted against the measure obviously felt that the slogan was anti-Semitic. With, for example, New York Representative Gregory Meeks saying, "If you consider the geographic area of the Jordan River and Mediterranean Sea to be exclusively Palestine, you are taking the Jewish state of Israel off the map." However, notably, he and many others also felt that the measure was an attempt to further divide the Democratic Party, which, you know, as a sizable progressive bloc, increasingly flexing its influence, with Meeks adding, "Well, I'm not happy that we have to consider this resolution. I do believe it was brought here, fortunately, by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle in an attempt to divide this House." And saying, "I also know the danger of the phrase in question. That is why the resolution actually has my begrudging support." And that mindset's actually why Representative Madeline Dean voted present, with Dean writing, "Since the fall, I've been firm that from the river to the sea has no place in discussing long-term peace for Israel and Palestine. But Republicans prefer games over bills to support our allies and humanitarian aid. We must be purposeful with our words and also with our time." What's also interesting is that this isn't the only issue surrounding Israel that has bipartisan support, where the majority of Democrats and Republicans actually support a two-state solution that would see the creation of independent and free Palestine alongside Israel. It's just they say they don't want it to come at the cost of Israel, as many believe the From the River to the Sea chant encourages. You know, we're likely going to see this split become a pattern, because this resolution, it's actually just one of 17 the Republicans are putting forward about Israel. Also, I will say the timing here is notable, because this is coming around the same time that the European Parliament's making its own moves to support Israel, or at least symbolic moves, right? The reality is that resolutions condemning phrases really don't do much on the ground. But notably, it still has an impact, because it drives narratives domestically and internationally, which can affect voting, which can then have an actual effect. But also, I have no idea what's about to happen in the House, because all of this is playing out as there's now a growing effort to get rid of Speaker Johnson, with it initially stemming from, who you'd expect, Marjorie Taylor Greene, with then Representative Tommy Massey getting on board, some sources saying others are ready as well. Right, and this connected to foreign aid bills involving Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine. But we wait to see what happens here. I'd love to know your thoughts on any aspect, whether it be the Osna Tabassum situation, the House vote, or the potential ousting. And then, finally today, I have that update that I promised to give you every 2 weeks, as well as comment commentary. We dive into the comments on the last show and see what y'all were sounding off on. As far as the update on those of you interested in the business side of things, on this week's new Limited Beautiful Bastard drop, we've got some clear winners, which you can still snag for yourself right now over on the site. The I Don't Know Where I'm Going tee taking gold, the new Yeah, No, I'm Fine gear taking silver, the only constant is change taking bronze, and almost making the podium was Go Easy on Yourself, though the tank top actually sold more than the shirt, which we never see. So I'm going to take a look back and see what other designs I might want to use to make more tank tops. So if you haven't snagged one yet and you want to, get it. And also thank you to everyone that took part in this drop. But with that said, jumping into the comments on yesterday's show, I got to say, I got a special joy with so many people being shocked we talked about the Warhammer 40K drop. With one of yesterday's top comments just being, "I never thought I'd see Philip cover Warhammer 40K news." But Atmatan saying, "The warp calls to us all." You know, all I can really say here is it benefits us to have some nerds on the team. And I genuinely mean that with love, because I always get a kick out of it, because one, the people that are a part of that community are like, "Holy shit, Phil's talking about this." But then also two, when we talk about something that's niche and we make it consumable to the mass public, there's a special joy I get to introducing people to a world or a situation that 90% of them are not familiar with. And as is often the case, no matter how niche a situation is, it's usually applicable to most people to some sort of human level. Also, regarding the question I connected to that story of what's the most aggravating retcon that you've experienced, a comment that I saw a lot of people making that ended up getting a lot of likes in a lot of different places was, "Somehow Palpatine survived," which a lot of people agreed with, but then also, like, in the comments, there was a nerd fight happening. Toxic Audrey saying, "But he didn't, he died. The Palpatine you see isn't the one from the Death Star that Vader killed. It was a clone made from his DNA. Snoke is also a clone. There was a cloning lab on Exegol. This was explained in the movie. And then others saying, okay, that explanation is bad and lazy, and that is why people are criticizing it. The writer explaining their work does not legitimize the work. It is entirely possible to have a narratively consistent pile of shit. I don't know. I didn't mind the movie. I don't get worked up about stuff like this, but I'm also kind of a normie casual when it comes to this sort of stuff. And then, as far as the other comments, there was a smattering of comments on all stories, but there was a bloodthirst for Live Nation and Ticketmaster in those comments. Sean saying, you're a company running 80% of the whole market. You are the threat, not the other way around. Super Livestream saying, Ticketmaster Live Nation needs to be forcibly shut down. They told the government back in 2010 when they merged that their merger wasn't going to create a monopoly. They own hundreds of stadiums and the sole sale of tickets for those stadiums as well on top of their ticket sale prices. Though others saying, it shouldn't be shut down, just broken up and brought under control. Others also sharing their shitty, overpriced experiences with Ticketmaster. But that is where I'm going to end today's show. Thank you for being a part of another one of my daily dives into the news. And I'll see you soon, because remember, my name's Philip DeFranco. You've just been filled in. I love yo faces, and I'll see you right back here tomorrow. You on my mind a lot. Don't need no time watch. I don't know how I got you in my pocket spot. Yeah, that's bae. Need you every day. You light my oxygen.